Good afternoon. This is Cal Winslow. I'm your host today, and our program is an Antinomian Hour. It's a new summer series of in-depth interviews with artists, activists, and writers. An antinomian, well, by that I mean someone who thinks for themselves, someone who does the right thing because they believe it's the right thing to do, and someone who does this and thinks this in spite of or regardless of what social mandates might demand. Our guest today is Denise Boggs. Denise is the director of the Conservation Congress. She's a conservationist. She's trained as a biologist, a graduate of Montana State University. She lived and worked for many years in Bayside, north of here in near Eureka. And she has a particular interest in our national forest system and has worked extensively in these in here in Northern California. Hello, Denise.
Hi, Cal.
Hi, great to hear you. I thought I might start out, Denise, by asking you if you wouldn't mind sharing a little about yourself. How did you get interested in the kind of work you're doing, conservation work? And maybe perhaps about your first experience as a conservationist. I think we'll then want to talk at some length about your work with the National Forest. But first, let's begin with some general information. Can you do that? How did you get interested in conservation?
Well, I've always had an interest in conservation. Probably since I was a little kid, I was one of those nerds that sent my allowance to conservation organizations as donations. So I guess I've considered myself a conservationist for a really long time. But as far as professionally, when I graduated from MSU, I got a job with the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks in their wildlife division. And I was a liaison to the first elk GIS study in the state of Montana. Basically, there were a bunch of elk that were radio collared, and we were trying to track migration corridors, which are largely on national forest lands. And our partners were the Helena National Forest, and the BLM was involved, and there was a mining company and the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Oh, and what was then known as the Soil Conservation Service. And so my job was to act as a liaison and help coordinate all these different entities. And then we would go up in a little fixed-wing plane and, you know, monitor the elk. Well, not really, only a few months into this study, I found out that the Helena National Forest was planning some major timber sales, and back then they were still doing clear cutting, and those clear cuts were right in the middle of the elk corridors that we were monitoring. So being naive, I thought that they must have made a mistake. So I went to the Forest Service and expressed my concerns, and their response was, oh, no, there's no mistake. And my response is, you know, we're spending millions of dollars on this state-of-the-art study, and you're going to be destroying the habitat and impacting the results of the study. So I was really angry, and I knew that there were some environmental groups that were filing administrative appeals. One of the main groups was in Bozeman, Montana. And so I contacted them, and I told them what was going on, and I gave them the information that they needed to file an appeal. I also filed an appeal on my own as an individual. And no surprise, I got in a lot of trouble with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and I got hauled in front of the director and, you know, yelled at and said that I couldn't file appeals. And I said, you know, when I took this job, I didn't give up all my civil rights, and I have every right to appeal this timber sale. So it was made very clear at that point, you know, we're going to make your life miserable. And so I just decided it wasn't worth it, and I didn't want to work for an agency that operated like that, relying on politics instead of science and refusing to take a stand for wildlife and their habitat. So I quit, and within about 24 hours, I was offered a job with a conservation organization in Bozeman, the one that I had given the information to. So that was the beginning of battling Forest Service timber sales.
Okay, and I was interested in thinking about elk. I wonder, I think most urban people probably think of elk as only being in Yellowstone Park or places like that. And here in Mendocino County, we have bears and lions, but few people see them. I don't think we have any wolves. Have you followed the issues of the larger creatures and the many which are endangered? And I wondered if you could just tell us a bit about your knowledge of the situation in the West with these animals.
Sure. Well, Rocky Mountain elk are not just in the park. They're all over the Rocky Mountains. And in fact, there are some Rocky Mountain elk on the Modoc National Forest in northeastern California. And there's also Roosevelt elk over on the coast by Redwood National Park. But elk are, at least in Montana, are actually under assault at the moment due to the livestock industry. They're obsessed with a disease called brucellosis, and they initially were concerned that bison from Yellowstone National Park were passing the disease on to their cattle.
Are these the ranchers, really, that you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, cattle ranchers.
Right.
And there has never been a recorded incidence of bison passing on brucellosis to cattle. And in fact, cattle gave the brucellosis disease to bison. A lot of people don't realize that cattle are, they're not native to this country, and they were brought over from Europe. And so they're really an invasive species, if you will, or an exotic species, but they're not native. And it's one of the reasons they cause so much damage to the land. Well, the ranchers here in Montana continue to persecute the bison in the park, which is a whole different issue. But now they want to go after elk. And it's going to be an interesting battle because going back to when I was working on that elk study, we knew that the elk in this area around Gallatin County and Park County near the park had brucellosis. And no one thought anything of it. No one cared about it. But the livestock industry, in my view, they're not concerned with science. And, you know, it's all about their own self-interest and, you know, the economic bottom line. And most of these folks have very marginal operations, and without federal subsidies, otherwise known as welfare, many of these ranches wouldn't even exist. So that's another issue that I find very nerve-wracking, is that, you know, wildlife is considered a public resource that belongs to everybody, and yet our tax dollars, instead of going to support wildlife and their habitat, are being redirected to support welfare cattle ranchers. But anyway, elk here in Montana around the park, the ranchers are lobbying to go in and kill any elk that are on their private lands. And virtually all of the private land in this area is historically a winter range, and this is where the animals go in the winter to feed. So the hunters are, you know, I think it's kind of split. Some of them are supportive of the livestock industry, and others are really angry, saying first it was the bison, now it's the elk, you know, what's going to be next? So at least in Montana, elk are, you know, the next whipping boy for the cattle ranchers. I really can't speak to, you know, other areas of the state. I'm not sure what the state Fish and Wildlife agencies are doing regarding elk, but that's what's happening here in Montana.
And could you give us an example of what you mean by, say, the scientific issues? Where is a place where, an example of where science is clashing with the practice you're describing?
Well, I'll give you a great example, actually. Over in Wyoming, which is our neighbor, and a lot of people, I don't know if they know it or not, but Yellowstone National Park, only the northeast corner is in Montana, and the rest of the park is actually in the state of Wyoming. And over near Jackson, there have been cattle mingling with bison from the park for over 50 years, and there has never been a transference of brucellosis from the bison to the cattle. And the cattle ranchers aren't, you know, going crazy over there. And yet we have 50 years of proof, and yet these Montana cattle ranchers still insist that their cattle are threatened by bison in the park. And this last winter, over 600 bison were shot and killed that left the park during the heavy snows in the winter trying to find lower elevation food. So to me, if you have 50 years of study and documentation demonstrating that there's no threat, and yet state agencies, the Department of Livestock is a state agency in Montana, and they just thumb their nose at the data, the science, and, you know, and this is just a microcosm of larger wildlife issues. Like when we get to national forests like the northern spotted owl, I think there is a real alarming trend these days to ignore science and manage wildlife using politics and economics. And I think the American people need to decide if they want to have wildlife on their public lands and even their state lands. And if they do, I think they need to speak out and get involved, because we're losing a lot very fast.
Well, I'd like to hear more about that, losing a lot. We hear in terms of threats to the to cattle and sheep, I guess, we hear quite a bit about the wolves of Montana, but also across the northern states, and possibly the possible reappearance of wolves in Northern California. What's the state of that argument? It seems to be quite fierce.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because that's that issue at this point is sort of the holy grail issue in Montana. And again, the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is not using science to manage wolves. There have been quite a few PhD wildlife biologists that have gone over their research, some from Montana State University. There's an independent wolf researcher up in the northwest part of the state. And through some of the legal issues that came about when groups were fighting for the delisting of wolves, this science...
Delisting, did you say what that was?
Yeah, the wolf was listed under the Endangered Species Act, and it was delisted several years ago, and there were environmental organizations that sued to keep the wolf under the Endangered Species Act so that it would have higher federal protection. Now wolves are being managed by the state in Montana and Idaho and Wyoming. And the first thing they did was implement a hunting season on the wolves. And the hunting seasons don't take into account breeding or pack social structure. And then since the initial hunting, they've instituted trapping and snaring and other insidious ways of killing wolves, to the point where wolves are being persecuted pretty much year-round in the state of Montana. This last year, their population dipped significantly for the first time, and they've been killing on average over 600 wolves a year. They've been killing through hunting, and now that they're adding trapping into the mix, we expect that to go up. As far as cattle depredation, it's rare. It's a very small amount. The published statistics show that cattle have a higher chance of being struck by lightning than being attacked by a wolf. And many of the wolves that the ranchers complain about, they'll just see a wolf, you know, running in the mountains, and they call Wildlife Services, which was formerly called Animal Damage Control, and they send trackers out, and they kill these wolves, and they've never done anything. And the other thing about that type of killing is it's very indiscriminate. You know, they don't even know if they're shooting the right wolf. So if there is a wolf depredating, sometimes they'll come in and wipe out the entire pack instead of just trying to figure out what wolf is causing what damage. But it's minuscule, and again, these ranchers are compensated for any loss of cattle. The federal government gives them money. And there are some ranchers who are trying to be predator-friendly, which is greatly appreciated. They're tolerant of wolves and other animals like mountain lions and bears and things like that. But in general, there is this just insane hatred of this animal, and it isn't based on anything logical or rational. It's just a gut emotive reaction from these cattle ranchers, and they don't want wolves here, and they would just as soon, I think, see them all dead. So it's a very sad situation, and you know, I've been pleased that some other states have been more progressive, like Oregon, for example. Wolves are protected in the state by the state. And my understanding is California just listed the wolf as a, I think it was a threatened, if not endangered, state species. So wolves that come into California are going to have protection through the state. And that's how it should be. You know, until they have the opportunity to establish some packs that can sustain themselves. And, you know, once they lose protection and hunting starts, wolves are very much like human beings. They're very social. They have families. They mate for life. The entire pack hunts and helps take care of the pups. So if you take out one of the alphas, or both of the alphas, the pups usually starve to death and the rest of the pack disbands. So killing one wolf in a pack can actually lead to the death of many others. And that's part of the science that's not considered. And most scientists, the federal government also, I mean, they're not blameless in this. The decision to delist the wolf was very, very political. Initially, Fish and Wildlife Service assigned six wolf biologists to review the information that the feds were relying on to delist the wolf, and all six said that it was bogus science, and they did not recommend delisting the wolf under the Endangered Species Act. And instead of going with that and, you know, going back to the drawing board and doing more research, they said, well, that's just their opinion. And they went ahead and delisted. So, again, it's politics are driving the management of large carnivores and large ungulates like bison and elk. And again, you know, I look at, you know, I live very close to Yellowstone National Park, and the number of people coming into the park grows every year. We have millions of people from all over the world coming to Yellowstone. The number one species they want to see is a wolf. And it's been that way for years. And seeing wolves brings millions of dollars to all these little towns, these, you know, these economies that live around the park that are small and there isn't a huge economic base. And yet the cattle industry really isn't providing anything to these communities, and yet they're having more say in how wolves are managed. And up until last year, the wolves in the park were not even protected. So hunters would wait outside the park boundaries, and the minute a wolf crossed the boundary, it was shot and killed. And the park didn't say anything for a long time, and then they finally came out and said, we would like to have a buffer here, because about half of the wolves in Yellowstone National Park were killed during the first two hunting seasons.
Let me ask you one more question before we move on, and that's your use of the word managed. I've been thinking about that listening, and don't they need to be left alone? What does it mean to manage wildlife?
Well, that's a really good question, and, you know, the science shows that wolves don't need to be managed, that they are self-regulating predators. And if left alone, they will, quote, manage their own populations. And study after study has shown this to be the case, that wolves will quit breeding when they've, you know, reached the maximum in their territories and the land that can support those packs. So I would agree that they don't need to be managed. They need to be left alone. But the states certainly don't look at it that way. And, you know, all of these issues come back to the same issue, and it's livestock, it's cattle ranching. And, you know, if you see a large animal being persecuted in the West, it's almost always due to cattle ranching. So I actually quit eating beef about 30 years ago because I just refused to support that industry. Hmm. And that was a way I could do it, was by not, you know, buying any beef and paying these people to do what I consider immoral and unethical behavior.
Denise, I need to pause for a moment here and identify our station. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow. Our program today is an Antinomian Hour, and our guest is Denise Boggs. Denise Boggs is the director of the Conservation Congress. Listeners, if you've just tuned in, we've been talking about the management or the problem of the management of wildlife in the West. Maybe, Denise, we should move on a bit here to your more specific work. Could you tell us what the Conservation Congress is and a little bit about what it does, and then I suppose we'll go on to the National Forests.
Sure. The Conservation Congress is a grassroots nonprofit organization whose primary mission is to protect and preserve the national forests in Northern California, with an emphasis on protecting the wildlife and the habitat that they need on those national forests. And we are a membership organization.
Okay. I see on your website that you say you call your group, your organization, Our Voice for the Commons. Could you explain that, the meaning of that? I suppose that's got to do with your mission and the commons.
Sure. Well, the commons refer to the fact that national forests belong to all Americans, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. People don't realize that national forests are federal lands. They were bought and purchased with tax dollars, and they belong to everyone. And they're, and I've noticed, especially in Northern California, that people, a lot of the people that live there, especially in the rural communities, seem to think that these forests belong to them, their community, more at the local level, not even at the state level. And they often think that, quote, outsiders have no right to be involved in what happens on those lands. And that's not true. Every American owns 192 million acres of national forest lands. Those are our commons, and the resources on those lands belong to all Americans. So that's what we're referring to.
Okay, and again, it's a lot. I'm not sure. I was looking at the website of the National Forest Service this morning, and I read 30%. It said of the land in the continental United or in the United States was Forest Service land. Is that too much? Where does that come from?
I think that number might be high. I'm not sure. I just know that the total acreage of all of the national forests in the United States is 192 million
okay.
acres. But I don't think it's that high, 30. It couldn't be 30%.
Yeah, all right. And I also read that their mission is, I think I got this off their website, maybe. This land is entrusted to the people of the United States as a commons for ecosystem preservation, recreation, and sustainable resource extraction. Now, that all sounds pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Well, the key words in there are ecosystems and sustainable. What was the word that you used there?
Ecosystem preservation, recreation, and sustainable resource extraction.
The resource extraction being sustainable. It is not being done sustainably, not by a long shot, and that's pretty easy to demonstrate. And as far as ecosystem preservation, that goes right back to if you're not using resource extraction sustainably, you can't be protecting the ecosystems. And I would argue strongly that ecosystems are not being protected on national forest lands, and particularly in Northern California. One of the reasons the northern spotted owl was listed as a threatened species was because of all the unsustainable logging that was going on. And a lot of it was high grading and logging the biggest and the best trees, the old growth, the late successional habitat, and that's the habitat that the owl needs in order to live. And so that was being logged off. And by the time the owl was listed, the remaining habitat, a lot of it, there was a lot less of it, number one. And number two, it wasn't the best habitat because the best habitat had already been logged. And now one of the issues that I'm dealing with is when the Northwest Forest Plan was put into effect, and again, I think people need to realize that they thought when the Northwest Forest Plan went into effect that everything would be wonderful for the owl and it would be protected. Well, it hasn't worked. In fact, the population of owls has steadily declined under the Northwest Forest Plan because it still allows for a lot of logging in owl habitat. And first, the Forest Service, you know, developed sales in what are known as matrix lands, where commercial timber sales are allowed. And they were staying out of owl habitat. But, you know, owls don't read maps and follow arbitrary lines. So an owl could be using matrix lands or nesting in matrix lands, and that wasn't really taken into account. Well, now that almost all the matrix lands have been logged off, again, unsustainably, what's left? The habitat that's in the late successional reserves that were set aside to protect what are known as late successional species, including the owl. Other species are like fisher or marten or wolverine. And so for the last 10 years, I have been battling one timber sale after another that is in these late successional reserves and also designated critical habitat, because the northern spotted owl is listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. And in every one of these sales, they claim that they're going to benefit the owl, and they claim that they're going to do that by taking the biggest trees, the best habitat, and leaving habitat that owls don't prefer or necessarily use. And their argument is, well, in the future it will benefit the owl. Well, the future is 100 years out, and the owl will be extinct by then. So they're not taking into consideration the implications of that logging right now in the short term on local populations of owls.
Denise, I wonder if we could back up for a minute here. I remember as a boy being taken by my parents camping into a national forest and camping in campsites that had been built by the Conservation Corps in the 1930s and the WPA, and getting the idea from my parents that we were in a sort of a park. And I think maybe lots of people think that the national forests are parks, but you're talking about logging in the national forest. Could you go back and explain why is there, I assume it's private corporate logging, why is this even allowed in the very first place?
Well, that's a really good question, and in my opinion, it should not be allowed. Because there's a conflict of interest. But there was a law that was passed called the Multiple Use and Sustained Yield Act, and it does permit resource extraction on public lands. But again, it was supposed to be done sustainably, and I don't think the intent was ever that corporations would come in, such as logging, cattle ranching, oil and gas development, coal mining, gold mining, you know, pretty much any type of extractive resource is occurring on national forest lands. And it's not being done sustainably. And we have seen a shift to where these corporations tend to have a stronger and louder voice on public lands management. And it's really unfortunate. And I think you're right that a lot of people think of these lands as parks and they don't realize that these activities are going on, but they are. And, you know, it's really sad because I love the Shasta Trinity National Forest and the Mendocino National Forest in particular. And, I mean, I could take you out and show you areas that have just been ravaged by logging. People wouldn't believe it. They would think that they were private timberlands because of the way they have been mismanaged and logged. So, you know, I don't know how to let Americans know that these are their lands and they have a right to comment and get involved and tell the Forest Service how they want to see them managed. But right now, I really do think that there's a conflict of interest, because I know just about every time I stop in the supervisor's office at the Shasta Trinity National Forest, I see people representing SPI, Timber Company. And, you know, they lobby and they have a lot of power. They have a lot of money. They have folks back in Washington, D.C., you know, who that's all they do is lobby for more logging and more grazing and all of these activities. And I find it kind of interesting because a lot of these folks, you know, they claim to believe in free enterprise and tend to be more conservative, and yet all of these activities are subsidized by taxpayers. So when logging occurs, we're using our tax dollars to make this happen. Just and these sales are below cost.
How is that? Could you explain how that works?
Sure. Well, there's a couple reasons for it. One, as laws have been relaxed and more logging has occurred, and when the construction industry took a dive, like back in 2008 through probably 2010, these companies continued to log and log and log and log, and there was such a glut on the market that timber wasn't worth much. And so they started exporting. Well, they've been exporting, but they were exporting more now to China and to Japan. And the way the Forest Service goes about developing these timber sales, they're largely responsible for the roads that have to be built in order to enter into these stands to log them. And the timber isn't worth the amount of money that it costs to build the roads. And roads are a whole nother issue. You know, there's like a $10 billion backlog of road maintenance. And so these roads are in poor condition. They're falling apart often, allowing sediment to go into rivers and causing erosion and fragmenting habitat, and yet they just keep building more and more and more roads. And wildlife, pretty much all wildlife, do not do well with roads. And even species that rely on early successional habitat, like deer, once you hit that, you know, 2 miles, about 2 square miles to the average mile, animals will avoid roads. And there are areas on the Shasta Trinity National Forest that have like 9 miles per square mile. And they're highly fragmented and they're in poor condition. And the Forest Service builds them knowing that they don't have the money to maintain them. And so all of this leads to what are known as below-cost timber sales. And I always look at the economics when I'm reviewing documents on a timber sale. And often one timber sale will lose millions of dollars, meaning that our taxpayer dollars are going to support the logging of our lands and the destruction of wildlife habitat. And it's absolutely insane. I mean, that's a type of welfare that private corporate timber interests are getting. And the same is true for livestock grazing on federal lands. The ranchers only pay $1.35 per cow-calf pair. If they had to pay the market rate on private lands, they're as high as $17 per cow-calf pair. So, again, we're subsidizing the cattle industry, again, with our tax dollars to graze our public lands. And it goes on and on. You know, mining companies don't pay royalties. And it's really a terrible situation because I think a lot of these corporations just look at public lands as a gravy train. You know, they can go in and do business and make a lot of money and not pay for anything. And I don't think the American people realize what's going on.
You know, Denise, fracking has become an issue that increasingly people are concerned with. And I wondered if fracking, following from what you've been saying, is or will become an issue in the public lands.
Well, it already is an issue, but more in different parts of the country. The Allegheny National Forest in Pennsylvania has just been devastated by fracking. And I've seen some aerial photos of the forest, and it looks like an oil field. I mean, it's crisscrossed with thousands of miles of roads and gas pads and all the infrastructure and development that's required to do fracking. There's also an emphasis more in the southeast at this time. I do think, you know, as companies do exploring, if they find gas and it's on national forest lands, then it will be coming to a national forest near you. And it's very insidious. It's very lucrative for the company, and it's very bad for our public lands.
I need to pause again, and for listeners who are just tuning in, this is Cal Winslow, your host today. Our program is An Antinomian Hour. Our guest is Denise Boggs, who's the director of the Conservation Congress, and this is KZYX, your Mendocino County Community Radio. And we've been talking about the national forests and the problems involved in how they are used, or we might say exploited. Sort of finishing up on some of those last issues, this is probably not a new question. People have heard it before, and I'm sure you've heard it a million times. But you talked mainly about the spotted owl. What about, if I could be the devil's advocate here, what about the argument that says, come on, this is one bird you're talking about?
Well, I just don't give any credence to that question. I mean, where do you draw the line? You could say that about any species. And, you know, the northern spotted owl is a very iconic species. Owls are one of the most popular species, if you will, worldwide. There's a lot of cultural significance and religious significance to various peoples. It evolved in the old growth forests. It evolved with fire. And it's beautiful. And it's a very gentle bird. Of many of the owl species, northern spotted owls are very gentle and friendly. They're not that afraid of people, which has actually ended up harming them. And I think they have a right to be here. They certainly have a right to be here more than cattle. Cattle are not native. and neither are pigs or chickens or any of the things that are developed through ranching and agriculture for food. Those are all non-native species. So where do we draw the line and say, well, we're going to let the owl go, or we're going to let the Pacific fisher go, or the American marten, or the wolverine? As a society, I think we're going to become incredibly impoverished if we take that attitude and say, well, we're willing to sacrifice this species. Because once you do that, then, you know, the line, it just goes down the line. And I firmly believe, whether people want to believe it or not, that, you know, we're animals too. And as we start losing all of these species, including some large species like the polar bear is very threatened now, eventually it's going to be our turn, and we're going to have no one to blame but ourselves because we've let everything be developed.
And I suppose the owl is also important as a symbol of what's happening to the land more generally. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, there are some maps available that showed the amount of forests from coast to coast in the United States in 1900 and those forests now. And we have less than 2% old growth in the entire United States. All the 98% has been logged off. And again, I like to bring that up with the Forest Service because they always talk about, you know, if conservationists aren't reasonable. And I'm like, well, you know, 98% has been logged. Is it too much to ask to preserve the last 2% for all the species that need that habitat? So I think the owl is iconic in showing what we've done to old growth forests in this country. There's not a lot left. And from my experience, the timber industry wants all that is left. Yeah. I mean, that's these timber sales that I battle, they still want the largest and the best trees. The Shasta Trinity has some sales where they want to cut trees 150 years old. Well, old growth is defined as 180 to 220 years. So these trees are almost old growth, and they want to cut them and claim that that's going to be beneficial to the owl, and it's nonsense. I mean, you could explain it to a 10-year-old, and they would say, well, that doesn't make any sense. But I've learned that the Forest Service doesn't make a lot of sense because they're being managed by politics and the economic interests of a private corporation instead of for the benefit of the species and the American people's enjoyment of wildlife.
Denise, you mentioned battling. Maybe you could tell us a bit about what you and your organization do. When you say you battle, what are you doing?
Well, it's mostly an administrative battle. I review environmental documents for timber sales, and I write extensive comments. There's what's called the scoping phase, which the Forest Service often just says, we want to do a timber sale here, and they don't give you a lot of information. So those are more general comments. And then the second go-round, they send out a proposal that is more detailed. And that's where I write exhaustive comments, and I send them scientific papers and literature citations, trying to get them to do the right thing and do a better job. And they are unanimously ignored. It has just become a paper game. The Forest Service has to accept public comment because of the National Environmental Policy Act, and they are supposed to read the comments and consider them, but they don't. And it's always interesting. I like to check the timing of documents, and sometimes you'll send in your comments, and, you know, 5 days later, they release a final decision, you know, with this document, and you know darn well the document was already written. There's no way they could have considered the comments. And then the next stage is when they release a final decision, there is an objection period. It used to be called an administrative appeals period, which people might be more familiar with that term, but the Obama administration changed the regulations, and now we have an objection process, which is very similar to the appeals process. The Forest Service almost always denies those, so the only recourse we have is litigation. And, you know, we've heard a lot about, well, they used to say the 29-cent postage stamp appeal. Well, postage has gone up, but I can assure people it's not that easy. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of time and research and writing and finding the science that is applicable to the issues. And, you know, we go to court, and we try to stop some of these projects. And Conservation Congress litigates quite a bit in Northern California because of the egregiousness of the sales and the violation of federal environmental laws. But overall, I think it's important for people to know that less than 2% of all timber sales in the country are litigated. And, you know, you hear about this paralysis due to litigation. Well, for the most part, the Forest Service gets away with doing whatever it wants because very few sales are litigated. Folks don't have the resources. My group is very small. We have a tiny budget, but we're very fortunate because we have a lot of public interest attorneys who are willing to take these cases for little to no money, and that's how we can afford to litigate these timber sales. And we actually have a pretty good track record. On the Mendocino National Forest, we've won two lawsuits last year. We have another lawsuit that is pending. And again, you know, I think it's important for people to know that in order to win a timber sale, we have to prove that the Forest Service violated the law. And, you know, I've heard people say, oh, well, you have the judge in your pocket. Well, I don't know how anyone could go about doing that. I don't even know these judges or anything about them. But they review the documents and determine that the Forest Service violated the law. And I think the other misnomer out there is that groups make a lot of money on these lawsuits, and my organization doesn't make any money on lawsuits. If the case is won, the money goes to these public interest attorneys who basically did the case for little to no money. So the attorneys get paid, as they should, because they did all the work. But the organizations don't get the money. But anyway, it really has become about the only way we have to stop timber sales is to file lawsuits. And I think that's really unfortunate, because that's not the way the system is supposed to work. The Forest Service should be, well, first of all, it should be obeying the law and not developing, you know, commercial timber sales that benefit private corporations in designated critical habitat, for example, for any species, regardless of whether it's the owl or, in Montana, say the Canadian lynx or something like that. And yet we see these timber sales over and over being developed. And again, it goes back to the fact that logging has not been done in a sustainable manner. So the biggest and best trees are what industry wants, and those trees are in these threatened species habitat.
Denise, we have a few minutes left, not too long, but some time. Why don't you talk to us a bit about the Mendocino National Forest, which is here in our county. And again, I looked it up, and it really sounds very nice. It says there are hardly, no roads that go across it. It says it's about nature and science, it's about conservation, it's about history and culture, recreation, camping, employment, fire prevention. It's got a category of just for kids. It's got photo galleries. You've told me it's kind of a problematic place. Could you tell me what you meant?
Well, it is, and you know, that's a perfect example of public relations. You know, I would take anybody out on the Mendocino and show them areas and ask them what they think. The Mendocino National Forest is a beautiful forest. There's no question about it. And there are still places that are very beautiful. You know, it tends to be one of the more isolated forests, and it doesn't get as much use, public use, as, say, the Shasta Trinity. And because of the fact that it doesn't get a lot of public use and it is isolated, industry has run amok there, and the Forest Service has allowed it. And, you know, the Grindstone District of the Mendocino National Forest is one of the major battlegrounds for me, because that's where much of the designated critical habitat for the owl is. And, you know, I've documented probably 15 major timber sales there in the last, I don't know, 10 to 12 years that have all been in owl habitat, that have cut down actual nest trees, meaning the tree in which the owl's nest was in. And, you know, you can say anything on a website that you want to, but that doesn't necessarily represent reality. And in my opinion, you're right, that sounds wonderful, but that's not a true picture. Maybe it's a partial picture, but it's not a true picture of everything going on the Mendocino National Forest. I noticed what you read didn't mention logging, and it didn't mention livestock grazing.
No, nowhere.
And it didn't mention mining, which is occurring there. And, you know, you use nice, fuzzy words, and people think, maybe that's why people think these are parks, because of that type of disingenuous representation, if you will, of, you know, what's going on the forest, when in reality there's all kinds of extractive use going on the forest.
And you know, our parks over here are all overcrowded. They're expensive. They've been on the verge of being closed over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. And people clearly love them and line up to get into them. And yet one doesn't think very much of about the possibilities of the public using, say, the Mendocino National Forest. I don't know too many people who tell me, oh, they're going camping. Some do, camping mm-hmm. over there. Why is that, do you think?
Well, it's a really good question, and I have gone over and over and over in my own mind trying to figure that out, and I don't know. You know, maybe the Forest Service hasn't done a great job of helping people to understand that they own these public lands, and you can go hiking and backpacking and camping and bird watching. And there's a lot of human-powered activities that you can do on your public lands, including national forests. And I don't know why more people don't make the effort to go explore. You know, I think some of it is just a sign of the times. People are so into technology, and you know, there's the nature deficit with children who would rather play a video game than be outside. But I hope the spirit of adventure hasn't died, and that there are still some people who want to get out and explore their public lands. They're amazing, and you know, we really are the only country in the world that has the level of public lands that we have. And you know, you can see the rivers and wildlife. There's mushroom picking. There's archaeological sites. The wildflowers in the springtime. There's also a lot of weeds from cattle, another drawback to livestock grazing. But anyway, you know, national forests are worth people's time to go explore. And, you know, it's something you can do for free. There's not a lot of activities you can do for free anymore. And I think even with state parks, you often have to pay to use those. And you don't have to pay to use your public lands. It's free.
So in the 2 minutes left, tell us why we should trek over to the Mendocino National Forest. What you've said, you thought it was an amazing place. Just give us some highlights, Denise.
Well, I just think it's a really beautiful forest. You know, on the Grindstone District.
Where is that?
Folks probably know where Willow is. That's where the supervisor's office is, and you
sure.
go in through Willow.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of bad roads that you have to drive to get into the heart of it, but there are a couple what I call superhighways as well that are easy for passenger vehicles to traverse. But there's a timber sale there called the Smoky Sale, and I've taken several spotted owl biologists out to look at it, and I go out there every year. I mean, it's beautiful. They're big, huge trees. There's lots of shade. They're very well spaced. It's like perfect owl habitat. Nothing needs to be done in this area, according to all of the biologists that I've talked to and that have gone out with me and looked at the project. And yet the Forest Service has a huge timber sale planned in there, and again, they want to take the biggest and best trees. So I think folks can't argue for something if they don't know what's there. So if you spend time on the national forest and you become familiar with areas that you like, whether it's the forests or creeks or rivers or, you know, whatever it is that you enjoy, the wildlife, then you can provide a voice for them because they can't speak for themselves. And they need strong advocates to tell the forest that what they're doing is wrong. And the only way you can do that is if you know the area.
Okay, Denise, we've run out of time, but thank you very much, Denise Boggs. Denise is the Director of Conservation Congress. It's been a great pleasure talking with you, worrying, of course, but what isn't? So thank you very much. And listeners, I want to thank you for tuning in and advise you to look at her website, which is conservationcongress-ca.org. And then finally, this is Cal Winslow. We've been talking about conservation, in particular in the national forests. Our program is the Antinomian Hour, and I'll be back next week at the same time. That's Thursday afternoon at 1. So thanks again to all, and good afternoon.